Now, as I said, folks, I'm joined by Senan Maloney. Senan is the political editor, of course, of the Irish Daily Mail, and he's the author of several books, one on the Lusitania called An Irish Tragedy, and, of course, the other, The Irish on Board the Titanic. Now, folks, as we all know the story of the Titanic there, it's been immortalised, I suppose, by Cameron there, and indeed the film The Titanic there, and, of course, back to the 1955 and 1956 film there again. There was another black and white film there of the Titanic, but as we all know, the famous passenger liner sank on her maiden voyage on the 15th of April 1912 there, about 200 miles, I suppose you could say, off Newfoundland there. And of course, following her collision with an iceberg the night before. The North Atlantic Ocean disaster, it claimed the lives of 1,514 people and is one of the most devastating marine disasters of the history. Of course, it was the largest ship afloat at the time of her maiden voyage and carried 2,224 people. It was basically, I suppose you could say, it was the, when the Titanic was built, of course, in Belfast, I suppose, it was the height of Victorian engineering. And of course, I suppose with the sinking of the Titanic, actually, the Victorians, I suppose, at the time realised, I suppose, that they weren't infallible there. They weren't infallible there. But indeed, I suppose, really, it was a lesson, I suppose, to the, lesson, I suppose, to society. It was a lesson to the world, actually, that nothing was invincible. As I said, she was built there in 1909 to 1911 for the British shipping company, the White Star Line, I think. Yeah, the White Star Line. Yeah, the White Star Line was passenger, and the Blue Star Line, I think, was freight. I'm not exactly sure on that, but indeed, I know a man that does. Senan Maloney, you're very, very welcome to the program. Indeed, thanks very much for dropping into us.
Sure, it's a beautiful morning here in Ireland. What else would I be doing? Great pleasure to be here.
Well, exactly, and indeed, you came at the right time, because if you came last week, like, you know, you'd have your umbrellas up and your Wellington boots and the devil knows what up, like, so.
Oh yeah, but yesterday and today, absolutely fantastic. And it's amazing to think that today is the exact anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic 111 years ago today, the 15th of April. And so 111 years ago, on the 11th of April, a few days ago, the Irish embarked down in Queenstown. I'm quite sure that many people from Yarl would have been down and taking an interest in this magnificent ship, because she drew crowds of spectators.
She was one of the largest ships, wasn't she?
She was the largest ever built by the hand of man at that time.
Was she?
She was. She was the largest moving object ever built.
Was there a sister ship?
There was a sister ship called the Olympic.
The Olympic, yeah.
But the Titanic was slightly larger.
Yeah,
the Titanic had about a foot and a half on the Olympic, which had made her maiden voyage the year before.
Yes.
And in fact, at one point, the Titanic and the Olympic were together in Belfast when the Titanic was completed, because the Olympic had lost a propeller and had to come back. And that actually delayed the maiden voyage. So it all adds to the catalogue of what ifs. That ended with the meeting of the ship and the great immovable object in the middle of the Atlantic, and it's still the greatest disaster on the North Atlantic to this day, in war or in peace. So, as you say, it was an awful shock to Edwardian society at the time, and a huge cataclysm here for many communities in Ireland, because at the time she was regarded as just the acme of emigrant ships,
yes,
if you like.
Yes.
Well, we were very used to taking the boat in this country, and 30,000 a year were going from the port of Cove, Queenstown, as it then was, named after Queen Victoria. Mm. And Cove was booming at all these boarding houses and so on for people who were making their last stops, taking their rest before they embarked the ship, you know. And many of the people who got on board the Titanic from Ireland had been booked on another ship, the Celtic. But funnily enough, there had been a big coal strike in England, and a lot of the sailings were cancelled.
Yes.
And so people were delighted. People who had bought steerage tickets to make their passage to America were delighted that they were being bumped up to this superliner.
Yes. Anyone, of course, I suppose, it was hailed, I suppose, as the ship of dreams at the time, because a lot of Irish, I suppose, you know, seeking their fortune, you know, in America there. And, of course, when even on steerage was divided into classes, was the first and steerage, and even at the steerage was something that they weren't so, you know, it was just above and beyond people, wasn't it?
This is it, and they said that steerage on the Titanic was equivalent to
first class, maybe in some other
more inferior liners, and certainly, you know, yes. And even second class on maybe Cunard going across the Atlantic, and certainly there were vast improvements even in steerage, but. Some of them would look antiquated today when you consider that there weren't, you know, I mean, who wants to sleep nowadays in a four berth cabin or to be in a dormitory with many other people and having to share toilets and so on. So there were toilet blocks in steerage, if you like.
And of course, it was very much, I suppose, class orientated as well, because dare the steerage meet with the first class or invade the first class dining room or smoking rooms or whatever the case may be.
That's touched on very well in the movie, and indeed, the steerage, you see, the steerage literally came from having steers when they were exporting cattle.
Oh, that's where it came from. Yeah.
So this was cattle class. I mean, it's like you know, we see it today in aviation. We're all crowded into economy class and so on.
Yes.
And then there are people who are cut above, separated by velvet curtains and so on. But when you were in steerage, you were certainly getting fantastic food. The food was an absolute cut above. So and there was heating as well. So for many of these people coming from, we're not far off from the mud cabins of old.
It was a huge culture shock for these people.
Didn't have running water or anything like that.
Yeah.
Very often, never mind electricity. And there was electricity throughout, you know.
Yes.
And there were some of the innovations on the Titanic included a third class smoking room and a bar. So these emigrants had their own dedicated
bar.
And of course, maybe that fueled the famous steerage parties. As you see portrayed in the movie, you know,
on the movie.
But certainly the Irish were celebrating and having fun. There was a chap from Athlone called Eugene Daly, and he was playing the bagpipes, said a second class passenger who was looking down on them when they were in the well deck of the all the way aft towards the stern of the Titanic, and they were having dances, and he was playing what your man called the bagpipes, but they were actually the Illan pipes.
Oh yes, Illan
pipes,
yes.
played with the elbow and so on.
Yes,
and he had been a member of the Irish National Foresters Band and so on, and he was emigrating, and he later claimed against the White Star Line for the loss of his pipes.
I heard that actually. That he actually claimed, and he got something.
And he got 50 bucks for it.
$50 for the
and
pipes.
Then, having survived this horrific shipwreck in the most extraordinary, terrifying circumstances, with gunfire and falling into the water himself, and feeling, he described afterwards, women's hair on his face, as they were all struggling to come to the surface.
My goodness.
He eventually survived on an upturned collapsible boat.
Yes.
On the hull of a lifeboat that had turned turtle. He survived all that, and 2 weeks later he was winning second prize at Gaelic Park in New York in a fesh with a borrowed pair of Illan pipes.
My God, the indomitable Irish.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I suppose, looking at the actual liner itself, as I said, like it was dubbed the unsinkable liner.
Yeah, and that was that was an amazing trade-off, really, because the British Board of Trade allowed the ship to be equipped with a low number of
lifeboats, yes,
on the grounds that the ship would itself be sufficiently well constructed with transverse bulkheads. Now, that's a posh word for a big wall in the middle of the ship running from side to side.
Mm.
Okay, so the ship is pointing forward. A transverse bulkhead is nothing less than a wall of steel followed by another wall of steel further aft, you know, and they would have, obviously, they would have
four or five of these different...
Exactly. So that compartmentalised the ship, and obviously there were access doors in between, but these were meant to be watertight doors. So in other words, it's portrayed in the movie when some of the firemen are scrambling out of affected boiler rooms.
Yes.
These watertight doors will drop, and that's supposed to seal off the ship.
Yeah. So if it hits, if you had a leak or a plate sprung or something like that,
you could compartmentalize it at least.
You could fill that bulkhead basically with water and the doors would close and et cetera, et cetera.
So the theory was that the ship was her own lifeboat.
Yes.
And therefore, you didn't need to clutter the... They were very worried about cluttering the decks and obscuring the views of the first class, finer class of people,
yes,
as they perambulated along the decks and took the sea air. They wanted to be able to look out over the ocean and not to have big wooden hulks swinging in their way.
And of course, you had, I suppose you could say, you had the best of, which, you had the millionaires.
Oh, absolutely.
On the ship, like, hadn't you?
The richest man in the world, John Jacob Astor IV.
Yes.
Who owned half of Manhattan and whose ancestors had made a fortune in the fur trade. So initially they made their money buying pelts from the Indians.
Yes.
We should say Native Americans now.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
But they bought all these furs, exported them to Europe, and made a huge amount of capital. And the Astors invested in Manhattan very wisely. And all their real estate values rocketed and so on. And so this man was probably the world's first billionaire in truth. And he was over here on his honeymoon with a new wife. He had
Lady Astor. Lady Astor.
No, she was related by another wing of the family, and she was in the she was one of the first women elected to the House of Commons. Not like her own. Yeah. She followed after her own Constance Markovitch, you know,
yes,
who was the first woman elected, didn't take her seat. Nancy Astor, who became Lady Astor, was then, is still viewed by the British, really, as their first female MP, insofar as she took her seat. Constance Markovitch didn't.
Amazing.
But although you're quite right, they are another branch of the family, you know. Mm. But this chap was over with an 18-year-old bride called Madeleine, you know. He had upgraded his spouse.
He's exactly, traded in for another model, yes. Sally, Kevin Millie is joining us. Kevin, come into the microphone, there's Bob.
One interesting thing about that is that Madeleine survived on lifeboat number 4.
That's right, she did.
Yes.
She would have been with her own Jack Foley.
Yeah.
With her own Jack, yeah. So we do have a connection.
I am not going to interrupt this fella down at all because I'd be way out of my depth here. But that's one little tidbit that maybe...
You're quite right, and he...
And of course,
another little tidbit is that she bought $800 worth of Irish lace from the traders that came on to the Titanic at Queenstown on the bum boats, and they would be hauled up by ropes, you know.
More than likely, it was lace that was produced in this building.
Irish lace, yeah.
Yeah, it was produced right here where you were sitting.
And did the lace from here go down to Ahern's? There was a famous shop called Ahern's on what's now Casement Square in Cove. And that shop supplied all the liners. So it very might very well have been
more than likely
Irish lace, yeah.
More than likely, because I do know
made in this very area.
Wow, where you're sitting. It was made here and upstairs.
Amazing.
So you're on hallowed ground.
Here at COY. I never knew that. That's fantastic, yeah.
But I suppose getting back to the Titanic again, it was, as you said, it was the cream of British society were on the Titanic. And indeed, I suppose, take us through the events, I suppose, leading up to the actual fateful hour that she hit the iceberg.
Well,
I think your theory is that it wasn't, we all know, it was a number of events that caused it. But one of the main events, I think, that caused it, and you'll be touching on it now for me, is a fire that was on board.
Yeah,
the hold. But just again, briefly take us up to the events, the events leading up to the collision.
Certainly, I'll do that. But first of all, we have to remember that the Titanic was built here in Ireland.
Yes,
by Irish hands and so on, north of the border. We were all one country at that time.
Yes.
So she sailed from Belfast on what's called the delivery trip to Southampton. Mm-hmm. Now, there happened to be an American passenger on board who had been visiting his sister in Belfast and then discovered that the ship was going all the way to America. And he took passage on her and he joined in Belfast. So strictly speaking, because there was one paying passenger, that might rightly be called the maiden voyage of the ship, because she went from Belfast to Southampton.
Yes.
And arguably the maiden voyage,
that was the maiden voyage,
is only the second voyage. You know?
Yes.
There was a fire on board. I referenced, Noel, the British coal strike earlier in our chat, which had paralysed shipping. It was a national stoppage. and homes were going cold and so on, and even trains were not running in Britain because of they were wholly reliant on coal.
Coal was king. There was no oil. Coal was king. Fueling the boilers for steam.
Absolutely. And it paralysed Britain, and it was hugely politically controversial. But it meant that the Titanic, on her departure from Belfast, wasn't equipped with the best quality coal. And nor was it bunkered properly later on in Southampton. But it is not theory, but established fact, and admitted by the chairman of the White Star Line, Harold Sanderson, that when she left Belfast, she had a fire forward on the starboard side, on both sides of Bulkhead E. Now, Bulkhead E is the wall we were talking about. It was the main collision bulkhead. And on the starboard side, the right-hand side of the ship, there was a fire in one of two bunkers. And
wasn't unusual in that type of ship, apparently. It was fairly common, but it happened now and again that a fire would break out due to a combustion of coal.
Yeah, coal is a very unstable substance.
It's yes.
very, very, behaves very strangely. You're not wrong, is that it was not unheard of, but it was still unusual. And if you had a spontaneous fire break out, it was capable also of developing into an explosion. So there had been a ship called the Cairn Rona 2 years earlier, sailed also in April, a passenger liner heading for the United States, and there was a massive detonation in one of her bunkers, and there was huge loss of, well, it wasn't huge loss of life, but there was loss of life, and the subsequent inquiry by the Board of Trade laid down a rule that you cannot put to sea with an untamed fire in your bunkers. That's the rule.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the Titanic did that twice. She did it when leaving Belfast with a spontaneous coal fire that they were trying to address. But what you have to really grasp in relation to this fire is that these bunkers, the ship herself was enormous, and these bunkers were enormous, and about as big as this building, a three-story building, right? Emptied out and filled with coal, and you've got a fire somewhere in there. Yeah. How do you address it?
Practically impossible to.
And in Southampton, they bored a hole in the steel bulkhead, and they were pouring in water on top of the fire, top of it as they saw it, or somewhere, with a view to trying to address it and dampen it down. But obviously, they weren't in the right place, and it was a complete guessing game. Because the scale of these ships had now grown to such proportions, they weren't able to put it out despite playing a hose on it all the time. Again, this is in the evidence. Mm. And when she sailed from Southampton, she still had the fire. And the fire broke out really badly, apparently, just after she had sailed, because the Titanic had a near miss with a ship called the New York that's well known in Southampton. But it's not well known that a little bit further out, maybe half a mile, she stopped for an unexplained 20 or 25 minutes, and there was a tug alongside her and so on. The story that was given later was they were taking off workmen and so on. Well, maybe workmen had been trying to address this problem that had broken out. In any case, we have firemen and stokers giving evidence about this fire that had been in the bunker, and which they were digging out. So they were digging out all on the way of the maiden voyage. Even when she was, they stopped here in Queenstown, and the managing director, J. Bruce Ismay, had a private meeting with the chief engineer. This came out in the evidence afterwards.
Yes.
And to my mind, that can only be about the fire. How are we getting on with that fire? We're not telling anybody about having twice broken the law in sailing with an untamed fire aboard, you know, and possibly discussing whether do we need to take on more coal in Ireland, because undoubtedly the fire contributed in the first place to the ship making a very speedy passage across the Atlantic, when they had promised beforehand in the press to conserve coal, because there wasn't very much coal around, and they'd mixed up all these other coals, Scottish, French coals, were barges towed across the channel from France. And, you know, and when you mix these volatile
coals. They don't. It's like sometimes cousins having a fight at a wedding or whatever. So yes, it makes things worse. Yes. But they were digging out. They were digging out this burning coal and throwing it into the bunkers because that's the best way to deal with it.
To throw it into a fire. Yeah.
So the ship was accelerating. They eventually got on the Saturday night, which is the day before the collision with the iceberg. They eventually got the those bunkers, X and Y, I think they're called, either side of Bulkhead E. They got those emptied. They emptied both bunkers. And they could see that the bulkhead inside was warped and dinged.
Yes.
And red hot. It was cherry red.
Yes.
Ridiculous, and they could... they could see her. It was there were convex and concave elements, so it was all bulked out.
Warped completely.
Warped completely. Yeah. And I did a documentary, which you referenced, in which I asked, you know, coal experts, like, what would have been the temperature of that coal? And the temperature was absolutely excessive. It was mind-boggling, really.
Yeah.
It was in hundreds of degrees. And I asked a metallurgist from Birmingham University. Now, what does that do to metal? And this was also briefly covered at the inquiry, but they really wanted to play it down.
Of course, the inquiry was a bit of a whitewash, wasn't it?
Yes, they were totally playing their own.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
they were playing their own hose on this evidence, if you like, themselves.
Yeah.
But this metallurgist from the University of Birmingham, on foot of what we know about the bulkhead, which wasn't terribly bulky, by the way, you know, it was only half an inch thick because they were saving on weight, because the greater the weight of your ship, the more coal you need to propel the thing across the Atlantic. Yeah. So that was as thin, it was about as thin as the depth of your hand, if you like, and had been rendered brittle by the enormous temperature that was placed upon it. So in other words, that bulkhead was now like glass. So when, on the Sunday, the 14th of April, the ship collided with the iceberg, and she was listing slightly to port, by the way, so she was slightly rising her starboard side because, and this had been noticed and written about by a second-class passenger called Lawrence Beasley, because they'd been taking all the coal from that particular place. The ship was listed out of trim.
Yeah, she was offside,
So she was kind of lifting her side to the iceberg, and that's exactly where she met us, you know. So that bulkhead failed fairly early in proceedings, and the question is, to what degree did that compromise the ship's integrity? They had been opening up beforehand to try and bring forward pumps and so on. So once water rushes through a hull, you get something called the free water effect, and it can take a ship down in minutes, you know.
Of course, but from one compartment to another, it went and went. And of course,
So I think there's no doubt that the prime, you know, cause of the accident, you know, Mr. Culprit is the iceberg. I think the coal fire certainly hastened the ship's demise, and she sank far earlier than they thought she was going to last.
Well into
the following day, and there would be a flotilla of ships around taking people off. She went down in 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Of course, there's a common misconception that Captain Smith apparently was trying to race across the Atlantic, and apparently the story, I suppose, at the time was that the Cunard Line put pressure on him to make New York, so he piled on the coal on the boilers and he increased speed, but it was the other way around. They were actually desperate to try and get rid of the coal quick.
Yeah, and the further thing is, as you've got two things going on. First of all, you've sailed, but you might have what appears to be the requisite amount of tonnage to get across the Atlantic, 6,000 tonnes. But in fact, because a lot of that fuel is inferior, because it's French, because it's Scots, because it's not Best Welsh. That was the standard coal for ships at the time was Best Welsh. Mm. As people here in Yarl will know from, because it's such a seafaring community, people will have heard that. And this gives you the best output. Now, if you're putting in inferior coal, you're getting less output. So your 6,000 tonnes is worth about, maybe in reality, is only worth 5,000 tonnes, right?
Of course.
Meanwhile, you've got a further problem insofar as you've got this fire which is eating away your fuel.
It's like
driving from Dublin to Galway with a fuel leak.
With a fuel leak, exactly.
And then you're overspending fuel by going too fast, which the fastness, in a way, was forced upon them. But then the managing director being on board, he's thinking, well, maybe this is a good thing, because if we post a fast passage into New York with the new ship, that'll be great. So he's caught by two competing considerations. Meanwhile, one of the key points is that was asked in the press and in Parliament afterwards was, why didn't the Titanic divert when she had notice after notice after notice coming in from other ships about this ice field that was lying in her path?
There were so many ships that radioed them to say, look, icebergs ahead, icebergs ahead.
And the answer is that she hadn't got the spare capacity of fuel to divert 150 miles to the south and then back 150 miles.
Hadn't she?
Because of the lack of coal. So if they had done that, they could foresee being adrift without power outside New York, you know, off Sandy Hook, a public relations disaster.
That would be terrible for the company. Yeah.
So in other words, they gambled.
When the ship went down, as you mentioned there actually, that it went down in a very, very short length of time, it actually snapped. It actually broke in the middle.
Did. Yeah, it broke between the third and the fourth funnels because of the enormous strain that was placed by having this. It's like inverting the Eiffel Tower, if you like, and having the heavy bit down below the water and filled with water.
Yes,
but caused so much pressure on the rest of the hull that it broke.
She just snapped. Yeah.
And most likely she broke from the bottom up. This is a hard thing for people to imagine, because if you get a Kit Kat or whatever and you crack
it's going
to snap from the top, right? But you want to, if you get your pencil and. What happened was that she jackknifed. This is also extremely common in shipping disasters. If you go onto British Pathé or any of these YouTube and you look at some World War One sinkings that are being filmed, you'll very often see that the ship will jackknife up. So it breaks from the bottom. And sometimes the bow briefly bobs back up to the surface before sinking. Hard to know whether that, it was very dark, of course. Some people claim that happened. It was a famous set of drawings inspired by a 17-year-old survivor called Jack Thayer that suggested the bow rose above the surface. But other people maintain that's against the laws of physics, because it would have been absolutely inundated and
of course,
very heavy and full of water. So the evidence is scant, but certainly she broke and then the stern fell back onto the water as depicted in the movie, and then the stern slightly pivoted around. It pivoted around as it began to fail itself and go down. So it turned around so the back end of the ship was now facing the opposite direction, and then that planed away. And do you know that there's a mile distance now
between the stern and the bow. A text is Kynol, can you ask Senan about Chocolate Mangate? Milton Hershey, who cancelled his reservations on the Titanic owing to last-minute business. And Mick Sheehan actually texted in this. He said, what time elapsed between the Titanic hitting the iceberg and its sinking? Yeah. And you were saying that it's 2 hours. Was
2 hours and 40 minutes. So she collided at 11:40 p.m., 20 minutes before midnight. Usefully, in fact, the crew watches were changing at 8 bells, which was midnight.
Yes.
So one watch was going off and another watch was coming on. And they would, the next watch would typically be roused about 15 minutes beforehand.
Yes.
So what assisted the Titanic was, as soon as they had taken time to establish the extent of the disaster and the ship was pierced in many compartments, and they did their computations and they realised this ship is going to sink. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
And initially, the managing director of the builders, Thomas Andrews, estimated an hour to an hour and a half. Now, miraculously, she lasted 2 hours and 40 minutes from 11:40 p.m. until 2:20 a.m.
Yeah.
But the advent of the other watch coming on board by the time they realised the seriousness of it, they kept the outgoing watch. They've got the new watch of sailors coming on duty.
Yes.
And started stripping the lifeboats and so on. Yes. So they didn't have enough lifeboats, but they didn't have enough sailors to put in them. They had firemen and so on, but they didn't have enough navigational hands, if you like.
We all know, I suppose, about, and of course, as you said, it's been well documented there in James Cameron's film there, actually, the Titanic, and indeed it's been, I suppose, one of the most documented, you could say, shipwrecks of all time. Can I ask you, Senan, the Titanic now, it's down at, what, nearly 2 miles?
Yep.
The condition of it now?
The Titanic is holding up remarkably well and is going to be with us for centuries.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it will, yeah. And this idea that there's going to be some sort of brown stain on the bottom of the sea floor in 20 years, and it's going to probably outlast the rest of the land with the way we're going with our climate change.
Yes.
Yeah. But so it's in a perfect environment in a way to preserve it, because it's totally anaerobic down there, and it's cold, and it's not terribly at the mercy of subsea currents, because it's so far down. So it's completely still down there. There's a couple of rat-tailed fish swimming, nosing about, and so on. But the ship is being slowly eaten by bacteria called rusticles.
Rusticles.
So
they
are noshing, if you like, on the
on
the steel.
Yeah.
And turning out what looks like icicles hanging down, brown icicles.
Yeah, we're all familiar with, I suppose, the Ballard, is it?
Yeah, Ballard. And so they discovered this new species of bacteria down there that's ingesting the ship, but at a fairly slow rate. So she still looks majestic. There was Titan Ocean Expeditions went down there recently and filmed in 8K. And the ship is deteriorating slowly, but it's not bad. For instance, a few things have happened since Ballard discovered the wreck in September 1985. One very bad thing, if you like, was the falling off of the lookout cage, you know, the crow's nest.
Yes.
So that fell off the main mast. The main mast was forced back onto the bridge, smashed the bridge as the ship was sinking.
Yes.
And the crow's nest was initially still on the mast, but it has now... It's flimsy enough structure in itself, but it's now fallen off the mast, you know.
Yeah.
And there has been some... There's been some loss to the decks slowly beginning to fall on each other. But she's not in as bad a condition as the Lusitania, which isn't very far from here, 15 miles from maybe from y'all.
But of course, there's probably more oxygen in the water there.
That's right. And she's been snagged by ropes from fishermen and so on.
And
it's even rumoured that the British were dropping...
Explosive, to hide, I suppose, what they had in it, you know. I suppose, again, and we've all seen the poignant scenes, I suppose, of the underwater exhibition. And when you think of the things, the items that they actually salvaged from the Titanic, like little things like shoes or handbags or something like that, like it brings the story, I suppose, really home, doesn't it?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And the two fantastic exhibitions permanently on display in north of the border in Belfast, this Titanic Belfast built on the slipways, which is an extraordinary achievement and a great day out. But also I should mention, if you take the Bangor Road, I think it's the A5 to Bangor, there's the Ulster Folk and Transport Museum.
Oh, yes, yes.
And they have some fantastic stuff as well, you know. They have amazing exhibits of some of the White Star uniforms, the posters, the lot, even little kosher dishes and cutlery that were used by the Jewish passengers on board because they had to separate, their dairy and so on.
Yeah.
It is absolutely extraordinary, yeah. And it just shows you what an industry emigration was. It was actually the steerage was subsidising the rich.
Of course.
Bizarre as it sounds.
Yeah,
these people who were living in suites, you know, and the finest parts of the ship were being subsidised by the poor paddies who are, you know, paying their 7 and 8 quid to go to America, you know.
My
goodness. So they were literally riding on top of us once again.
It's a fascinating and tragic story. And of course, far more than our interview, of course, will be revealed tonight, Kevin, in the Mall Art Centre.
Well, you know, anybody with the slightest interest in Titanic really shouldn't miss the opportunity to...
Yes.
Because he's a real authority on us, and anybody listening to the show now can help but pick that up.
Yes,
I think it'd be a really missed opportunity not to go.
Of course,
tonight. I'm really looking forward to it, really.
I think we all are. I think we all are.
I just sit back and listen to him.
Absolutely. Like, and I have to congratulate you, Tenen. It's absolutely a fascinating, and you gave us so much insight into it, into the background of it.
And we'll have a few surprises tonight because, as Kevin knows, we were busy doing a bit of carpentry yesterday with a view to producing a sensational new model.
A prop.
All will be revealed. All will be revealed.
Seeing as we're here, I would just like to say, a couple of years ago, myself and Peter Landers were kind of scratching around, really.
Yes.
Fumbling. We had two battered photographs of, the Jack Foley was in, and we basically had nothing else. And somehow we got Senan's number, and we rang him up. It was a cold call. He wasn't expecting it. But as soon as he understood what we were trying to do about the plaque and the booklet and whatever, he sent us everything that he had gathered over a long period of time, and he willingly did it. And, we can't put into words really how much that meant at the time. I know that when I showed some of the stuff to Peter Landers, he had to sit down because we never expected any of it, and he willingly gave it. And I just like to thank him for that. Now, I'd done it yesterday, but on the radio, people ask, where did you get all this stuff? Well, we got it from Senan. Simple. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I'd like to pay tribute to Kevin Melly and to Peter Landers themselves. Well, and to everybody who aided them in Yarl, because it's I'm deeply impressed about how, people got off their seats and did something about local heritage. And I was making the point to Kevin yesterday when I was looking at the fantastic plaque to Jack Foley that there is here in Yarl, that this is enrichment, this is value added for the visitor to the town, and it is also the town acknowledging one of its own and a man who undoubtedly played a hero's role on that night and pulled people in from the freezing water in the pitch dark. You can't imagine what a horrific
scene
cataclysm it was, and this man stood up to the mark,
Yeah, and as well as I have to congratulate you, Kevin, because without you and your team, the story of Jack wouldn't be here.
Quite right.
He'd be lost in the midst of time, wouldn't he, Jack Foley? Would be the last, because we never heard. I never heard of Jack Foley until you came on with McSheehan one morning talking about him.
Well, I was lucky enough to meet, Liam Mulcahy.
Yes.
And I was pretty young at the time. And Liam was very proud of him because he was related to him.
Yes.
And I wouldn't have known it either, except Liam. But Liam was very, very, very proud of this guy, And I always had it. I brought it up several places and it was kind of scoffed at and laughed at, really. And it wasn't really until I met Peter, and Peter said, we're going to have to do something about this. That kind of stiffened me to...
Yes, I had him in my book, of course. So I brought my book out about at the turn of the century, The Irish Aboard Titanic.
Yes.
And I made sure to give an honoured place to Jack Foley for all he had achieved.
This is how... I rang up Senan to get the photograph that he had in that book, The Irish on Board Titanic. There was a little picture, and we wanted that picture.
Yeah.
And that's where it all led to. And then he sent us all the information, the marriage certificates and the census records.
And looking enough, to my own researches, I'd been able to find his family in England, which enabled them to famously come over here and so on. And it is an extraordinary story. And I know I think that one of the reasons there were doubters over here is that because when people looked at the Titanic crew manifest, there was a terrible accident whereby Jack Foley, when he was standing by the fellow who was writing in his name on the crew ledger, was asked where he was from, because you had to fill in your age and where you were from, your home address and so on. He said from Yarl, but the chap heard York.
Oh, yes, obviously.
Wrote in York. So Jack Foley appears to come from York.
From York,
But actually on the delivery voyage I was telling you about from Belfast to Southampton, it's completely correct there. He's down as, J. Foley Yarl.
Yes.
And on all his seaman's cards and so on, and all his discharge dockets and so on, I've been able to supply to Kevin, showing clearly, absolutely clearly, that he was always from Yarl. And he belongs to Yarl, and Yarl must remember him.
Finally, before we leave it, because I know time is of the essence with this year, and we're fast running out of time, I do want to, and I do know that there is, and I've heard someplace that there was another Yarl connection with the ship that finally reached the Titanic, or the survivors of the Titanic, what was left of them, basically, the Carpathia. Wasn't there a connection with the Carpathia as well?
Well, now you've caught me completely there.
I
was quite happy to talk about the chocolate magnate Milton Hershey from Pennsylvania. Yeah. I could have bored
you. I'm sure there was some yawn connection, but we shall explore that.
But no doubt there was, actually. And when I go home from this, I'm going to email my top man on the Carpathia, because there's a German chap called German Swiss, I should say. Mm. He's Swiss. He's from Zurich. Gunter Babler, and he has been here to Yarl, because he runs a worldwide website on Titanic memorials around the world, and he was very pleased to incorporate the plaque that Kevin Melly and Peter Landis put up. Yeah,
brilliant.
So you can find that on the internet now.
There is some. I know there is some connection. I don't know how good or how bad it is, but I do know there's some little connection between Yarl and the Titanic. Maybe anyone of the listeners out there,
they might have an idea.
They might have an idea.
Certainly, Gunter is writing.
Give us a text in, folks.
He's writing a book on the Carpathia. Yeah. So if anybody knows, he'll know. So I can report back.
Seven, it's been great having yourself and Kevin in, and you're a breath of fresh air. And indeed, thanks very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to drop into us there and enlightening us all. The talk is on tonight, as I said, a talk on RMS Titanic, and he'll also do a question and answer session. So if you have any questions to fire at Sinan, I'm sure late this morning he'll be more than capable of answering. The Caddish Dock is free. There's too many things you get in this life for free, but this is one of them. Thanks to Kevin Melly and his team there. And it's starting at 7:30 sharp at the Mall Arts Centre. The MC for the night, of course, is our very own Tommy Collins. Lads, it's been great having you in, and thanks very much for taking the time coming in.
Thanks so much, Noel.